This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
I'm Michael Williams. I'm the director of the Wheeler Centre, and most of my responsibility tonight is not to let my massive excitement and fandom overwhelm the event. We have Philip Pullman down the line from his Oxford home. It'll be about 45 minutes or so, because unfortunately that's all the time we've got. So we're going to try and make the most of it. I would love a chance for you to ask questions of him, but the mechanics of it we think may overcomplicate the evening. All right, Jumbo, let's see whether we can get the line open. This is, you get to see the sausage being made here.
Hello?
Philip Pullman, it's Michael Williams from the Wheeler Centre in Australia. You are actually immediately, straight away, appearing on stage in front of a room of a couple of hundred of your most adoring Melburnian fans. Is that okay, or would you like a moment to compose yourself?
I'm fine. I've been sitting here waiting eagerly to speak to everyone. So
excellent. Well, we have audio but not video at the moment. Can you tap the video part of your screen for us?
Oh, yeah. I forgot to do that. Okay, there I am. And now I'm looking at the right place, I hope. Hello.
I am going to keep my introduction very short because we don't have you for very long, but when the Wheeler Centre had the author Hanya Yanagihara as a guest last year, the interviewer asked her about New York in her novel and how she knew that she'd got the depiction of it right. And she said, more than anything else as a writer, the thing that she was determined to do was have her New York be an approximation of Philip Pullman's Oxford. That the combination of the real world and the imagined world had to come together. And it was a moment, you could feel it in the theatre of a couple of hundred people here in Melbourne, was that immediate moment of recognition. Readers the world over knew what it meant to create an imaginative world with the style, the grace and the generosity of Philip Pullman. Melbourne, please make him very welcome with a big, raucous round of applause.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to sour your relationship with Melbourne immediately by saying that you once lived in Adelaide.
That's right, yes. I'm very glad to be present in Melbourne as an image, but I've never actually been there in the flesh. When I was a boy of, I suppose, eight or nine, we came to live in Adelaide because my stepfather was an officer in the Royal Air Force and he was posted out there. And my mother and my younger brother and I followed by sea, because that's the way you travelled in those days. And we lived in Adelaide for, I suppose, about a year and a half. And I loved it. I remember it with enormous affection. And I learned a great deal there. My eyes were opened in all sorts of directions.
I do love that one of the things that characterises your work, beyond the kind of generosity and the curiosity that I talked about before, is you are obviously an enormous reader, and I understand you're a big fan of The Magic Pudding.
Yes. It's the funniest children's book ever written. I first encountered that, of course, in Adelaide in about 1956. I loved it at once. I read it all my life. I can quote large passages by heart. And a few years ago, I wrote an introduction to it for the New York Review of Books, Children's Classic Series. So, yeah, Norman Lindsay. And I've got, I can reach to the shelf just beside me. And there is a copy of a book by Norman Lindsay.
That is pretty fantastic.
That's a funny little novel called, I can't put it down now, A Curate in Bohemia, which is a very funny book. Set in the world of art students in Melbourne in, I suppose, about 1906, something like that. I love Norman Lindsay's drawings, and I love his prose, too, for the vigour, the exhilaration, the sheer fun that he seems to have had in every aspect of life.
The energy and imagination, anyway. But I'm thrilled to be talking to you while you're in your study, and you can reach out and grab props at arm's length at a moment's notice.
You gave me a very good cue with that one.
I'm going to be testing you.
If you mentioned something else, I wouldn't have been able to do it. But Norman Lindsay happened to be right.
I'll be testing you for the whole conversation. At some point, I expect your dogs to run into frame, and then I'll be very happy.
No, they're kept out of the way for the moment.
It's probably a good idea. You don't want to be like that career expert on the BBC and have unwanted guests in your interview.
Oh, I remember that. Yes, that was funny. Yeah.
Now, the other thing that came out of Adelaide, of course, is you're in South Australia. The year was 1956, and you're in South Australia for the extraordinary flood, which is an event that has huge resonance for fans of your new book or those who are discovering it. I was told that standing on the steps queuing to come in tonight strangers were comparing notes on how far in they were on the new book and giddy with excitement at it. But there's a flood that's central to it and a flood that is not so much biblical as other kinds of forces.
Yes, that's right. To come back to the 1956 flood for a moment, we weren't directly affected where we lived in Adelaide because it was mainly the Murray River, I think, the Murray-Darling River Basin that was flooded. But my stepfather did put us all in the car and drove us out to a place from which we could see an area of flood. And I remember very vividly an enormous expanse of grey water sweeping with inexorable force from my right to my left where we were standing. And it was a cold day and the wind was whipping it up into white caps. And it was an image that I never forgot. And when I was writing this book, set, of course, in Oxford, and set in a very watery Oxford, because the hero of this story, Malcolm Polstead, is a boy who lives by the river and he has a canoe and he spends a lot of time on the river and on the many streams that go through and through Oxford, some of them disappearing underground and appearing again, and the canal, of course. So it's a very watery story. Malcolm has a very watery view of Oxford, unlike Lyra's view, which was one of the academic world and college rituals and splendour and architectural glory and all that sort of thing. Malcolm's world is a very much more workaday, working class, river level view. And as I told the story, I could see there was a flood coming. And the flood stirs up, well, all kinds of things that have been buried for a long time that don't seem to belong to the normal everyday world. That's what great natural events do. They change our perception of things. So I was glad to draw on my memories of that cold day back in, whenever it was, 1956, when as a small boy I saw a little part of that great flood.
I can say with confidence it's the only time 1950s Adelaide has ever inspired anything. So that is magnificent, I think. So it's 22 years since Northern Lights came out, since you introduced us to Lyra and this world. It's an extraordinary achievement. It's a book, it's a series of books that are very dear to my heart, and I know many readers all around the world. You've described the new trilogy, The Book of Dust, as an equal rather than a sequel or a prequel, but this first book lays the foundations for events from before His Dark Materials. Did you know these events before you started this trilogy, or did you discover them in the writing?
I think I always discover things in the writers. I made the mistake early on in my career, a long, long time ago now, of planning a book, making a detailed scenario and planning it all out in advance. The result of after months of work was I was sick to death of that damn thing and I threw it away and started another book with no idea where it was going and felt much happier about it. So I didn't know what was going to happen, though I felt it was going to be watery. I felt there was going to be a flood in it somewhere. The chronology of this is kind of complicated, I suppose, but the reason I didn't want to call it a prequel, although this book happens before the events of His Dark Materials, is because I don't like that word very much. It's kind of an invented word. And although the events come before, it isn't a prequel. And although the events in the second book and the third book will come after His Dark Materials, they won't be sequels either, because it's not the same story. It's a different story. So it's not a prequel, it's not a sequel, it's an equal. And that's my soundbite, and I'll get it in every interview I do.
While I was aware of the soundbite, I hadn't realised that it stemmed from a contrariness about the actual word prequel. That makes me even happier, that it comes from a desire not to let a fake word get its traction in the language.
Absolutely.
So returning to Lyra as a baby, I mean, the events of this book and their relationship to the His Dark Materials trilogy, some of it is about setting it up. It's about getting Lyra to the place where we need her to be for Northern Lights. How do you have both that discovery while at the same time knowing the end point?
I don't know. Now you ask me. If I thought of that question on the way through, I might never have started.
Oh, thank God we didn't talk.
I wanted to get Lyra to that point, to the point where she's going to be at home for the next 20 years. And I wanted to show some of the things that led up to that. I wanted to show a little glimpse of Lord Asriel and Mrs. Coulter, I wanted to show some other characters too, whom I didn't know before I started writing the story, but who are going to play a very large part in her life later on. This is a sort of setting the scene, probably, and it's going to be a rather odd chronology, because in the next book we're going to leap 20 years. But some things, as in life, as in stories, are planted and take a very long time to germinate and come to fruition. So we'll see in the next book, which is called The Secret Commonwealth, and it's already written, but it's not yet edited, so I'm working on that at the moment. We'll see what happens next.
The danger of describing it as scene setting, and you're allowed to do that because you're the author, but is that doesn't do justice to what an extraordinary book and tale this is in its own right, and in no small way because of the new characters you mentioned. Malcolm and Alice, in particular, are kind of as powerful, as indelible characters as those that your readers came to love in the first trilogy.
Thank you.
Tell me about creating those new children, because they're quite different to Lyra, they're quite different to Will, they're their own distinct characters. But you write children better than any author I know, I think. Where do you begin?
A great compliment. Thank you, that's a great compliment. I don't begin by creating them, that's the thing. I think I discover them. The characters come to you more or less full born, and you get to know them as you write about them. I couldn't sit down with a blank sheet of paper and a list of characteristics and add this characteristic and reject that one and then add another one and make up a person. You can't do that. They have a sort of platonic reality or something in some realm that we don't inhabit all the time where we are, but they seem to come alive. Malcolm, I'm very fond of Malcolm. He has a sort of gravity, a sort of a seriousness of purpose, which I admire very much. Alice, I just love Alice. I think she's terrific. And as with Lyra, they're not special kids. They're not divinely gifted or brilliantly clever or anything of that sort. They're just the kids that you would see in any classroom in any country in the world. I used to be a teacher for 12 or so years, and I taught many girls like Lyra. I taught many boys like Malcolm and like Will. And I've known many girls like Alice, too. They're ordinary people, and that's what I wanted to stress.
Do you tap into your own memories of childhood for that, or is it far more from that time as a teacher, far more of the children that you've encountered in your life as an adult?
It must be both, I guess. When I was a child, we were certainly freer than children are now in my country. Everything seems to be so much more crowded now. I remember when we were living in Wales, from when I was 11 onwards throughout my teenage years, we were free to come and go and range over the hills and on the seashore and explore the rivers and just run wild, basically. And my parents didn't mind about that as long as I came home for tea. Nowadays, of course, if you live in a city in this country, it's the traffic. You can't play in the street anymore. There's too much traffic. People are worried about letting you out of their sight because all the dangers we're continually told about on the TV and in the press. Children have a much more circumscribed life now. And also there are other things for them to do. They all have iPads and phones and so on. And that exposes them, of course, to all kinds of bullying and pestering and anxieties that we didn't have when I was a boy. So in some ways, the world of childhood is a foreign country to me now, the world of modern childhood, which is one advantage of writing fantasy, because I can simply dispose of the things that aren't very convenient. Wouldn't be very convenient in my stories for everybody to have a mobile phone, because they could just get out of trouble by calling for help.
It's true, although
fantasy allows me to get rid of it.
It's true, though, letting your demon carry your mobile phone around wouldn't be the worst kind of use of it. You wouldn't have to put it in your pocket.
That's right.
Seems a bit unfair. The thing that I've heard you say about children that I love, and I think is part of why you write them so well, is that children aren't less smart than adults, they're just less informed, which is a lovely line and idea. And I think part of what characterises your characters, and it's true again in this book, is you let them both be children, but you let them grow up. You don't talk down to them or assume that they don't have a capacity for a full gamut of what we think of as adult emotions.
Thank you for that. That's a great compliment. I'm very interested in this period of adolescence because I remember my adolescence very well. And it is a time when children are beginning to wake up in an intellectually curious way. Either at school or at home or by accident or by chance or by deliberately looking for it, begin to ask questions about the world and the universe, which the answers we've been given up till then aren't sufficient to deal with. We might find walking along a suburban road and hear through a window somebody playing Mozart on a piano. And the melody just captures us, and we don't know idea why. We stop and listen to it, and it awakens a hunger in us, or we read a scrap of poetry, or we see and it awakens a hunger in us that we didn't know we had. We are hungry suddenly for something that we had no idea existed, and we must spend our lives in search of this. It's a fascinatingly and astonishingly exciting time to be alive. I'm interested in writing about characters who are discovering this for themselves and also discovering all the changes that are going on within them, in their bodies. The bodies are changing shape, which is embarrassing. It makes you self-conscious, but it's thrilling too in a way that you can't really talk about or even explain even to yourself. This is the most extraordinary time in our lives, and I'm pleased to have been able to write about it.
For you, that discovery of hunger, was that always writing and literature and words? Was that, for you, that galvanising moment as an adolescent, that you knew that this was a language you wanted to speak, a register you wanted to operate in?
I think it probably was, though I was equally excited by music and by painting, by visual arts. There weren't any museums near where we lived in Wales, so we had to wait until my rare and occasional holidays in London before I could go to the National Gallery and look at paintings. But that was a moment of great discovery too. And I remember, you know, getting some charcoal and a drawing pad and trying to draw a tree or a wall or a field or something, and feeling involved in the same activity that, well, I wasn't on the same level of them, but I was doing the same kind of thing. I was in the same game. And I felt that with poetry very much. Poetry was always the more than stories initially, was always the great key for me. I love poetry. I love the sound it made. I didn't understand it always, but I didn't need to understand it because I'd got the idea that if I just spoke it, if I read it aloud, it would communicate something to me, and it did, and it still does.
I heard an interview with you where you talked about the fact that before you know what the meaning and the content of the next sentence is when you're writing, you know what the rhythm of it's going to be. You know how it's going to feel on the line, what the cadence needs to be before you kind of fill in the gaps of meaning, if you like.
That is true, yeah. Because when you're writing prose, you're not writing something unrhythmical, unmetrical. If we write iambic pentameters, we write blank verse, we know how it goes. It goes da-dum, 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 and so on, line after line. And we can understand the meter of that. But prose has a meter as well. And properly composed and thought about and heard prose has a rhythm that helps you through the paragraph, that helps you through the page, that has its own momentum. And in order to hear this, to be conscious of it, I have to work in silence. The thing that I can work with a bit of noise going on, dogs barking isn't too bad, and children playing is fine, and I don't mind traffic, and even the occasional pneumatic drill or planes going overhead doesn't bother me. The real problem is music. Music is an absolute killer when it comes to writing. I have friends who write their books with music playing. We hear about people writing this book to, you know, rock and roll or whatever it is. I don't know how they can do it, because you're either not listening or, well, something's going on. I have to have this a rhythm-free oral landscape so that I can hear my own rhythm when I'm writing.
One of the things that fascinates me about hearing you speak and your work, and forgive me if this is a kind of facile or reductive way to think about it, but you strike me as a person of deep... spirituality is the wrong word, but a deep faith in humans, in creativity, in the universe, in ways that in ways that are kind of incredibly hopeful. How much is your feeling about organized religion at odds with your belief in the universe?
It's not at odds with it at all, because the faith in the universe that you mentioned, which I'm flattered to hear about, that's due to nature probably, and the fact that things exist rather than not existing. Organized religion is, and always has been, a way of sort of codifying that and making it to a sort of tabulated series of rules and dogmas, which once those who believe those things acquire political power, can do enormous damage. If a religious body or an organization or a religious person acquires political power, it's very easy for them to believe that they are doing this because that's what God wills. And God wants them to regulate how other people live their lives. God wants them to tell people not to uncover their legs and cover their faces with veils. God wants them to cut people's hands off if they steal or rob. God wants them to do all these things. And in Western Europe, we had the Spanish Inquisition, and we had the persecution of the witches, and the countless horrors carried out in the name of religion. That's my problem with organized religion. But religious questions, such as why are we here? Why is there something rather than nothing? Is there a purpose to life? Those are important parts of our being human. Every thinking person has wondered about these things, and so there's nothing. Nothing wrong, and in fact, everything right with thinking those, wondering about those things and seeking answers for them. But I haven't found the answers for myself to be in organized.
So, do you have faith in people? I mean, in the natural world, absolutely, but what about people? Because I'm often pessimistic. Not this room, they're lovely people here, I assure you, but elsewhere.
It used to be a matter of 52-48. I was 52% optimistic. I'm now 51% optimistic because of what America's done in electing their current president, and because of what my country's done with its absolutely stupendously stupid move to leaving the European Union. So my optimism was good. Gone down towards 51-49. It's not quite 50-50 yet, because I try to maintain the balance on the side of hope, because, as I keep reminding people, hope is a virtue. It's not a temperament. It's the name of a virtue, which is something we should do because it is good. It is good to hope. It is good to maintain your hope and your optimism. So I try to do that. So it has gone down from 52 to 51.
That 1% feels very important. I'm going to be watching the trajectory of that closely.
Yeah.
I noticed ahead of the last election, your Prime Minister, Theresa May, when asked for the worst thing she'd ever done in her life, said as a child she'd run through a field of hay, which was widely derided as not a very good example of having done something bad. Oh, I may have lost you by offending your Prime Minister. I suspect not, but we may see if we can get the line back. I will use this pause to say that anyone who got... Oh, there we are. I can hear you briefly.
You're back.
Hello. Welcome back.
Yep, I can see you again.
Sorry about that. I know insulting Theresa May is a touchy proposition. I think the lesson here is even mentioning that woman by name might break the link.
Yeah. Okay, I think we can hear each other again.
Well, hearing, I think, is more than half the battle. There was an excellent piece, and I recommend it to everyone, to coincide with the publication of this new book in The Guardian, where a number of both your famous fans and Guardian readers asked you a series of questions about your writing and about the book. And one that really jumped out at me that I wanted to follow up on was the one from former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, who asked you about the role of culture in Lyra's world, that we know what the feeling about science was and the impact on the studies of science. But Your books are so deeply literate and so versed in the world of readers and people who read. I was interested by that question. Is that one that has occupied you in the past?
That was a very perceptive question by Rowan Williams, and it made me think a great deal. Culture would vary, of course, because if you've got the scientific method, if you've got the idea of forming a hypothesis, testing it, and rejecting things that don't work, then you're going to discover the same things whatever universe you're in, because the law of gravity won't be different. The laws of, you know, electrodynamics and all that sort of thing are going to be the same. So science will make the same discoveries. But the arts will not necessarily develop in the same way. And in fact, the question is really, does art develop at all? If you look at the amazing cave paintings from the Chauvet Cave or the Lascaux Caves in France, from 30,000, 20,000, 30,000 years ago, you can't say that we can draw better than that now. Nobody's ever painted. So we haven't developed in that sense. The arts change and flourish and learn from each other all the time. But they don't develop in the way that science does. They don't develop towards greater precision or greater truthfulness. So Rowan Williams' question did make me think. And, of course, there is a world of culture in Lyra's world, though I haven't had occasion to explore it yet. However, I can tell you that in the second novel, Lyra does at various points quote the French poet Baudelaire. So she's clearly been doing some reading, and there was clearly a Baudelaire in her work. So, but more than that, I can't say at the moment.
Can I check, is Baudelaire in her world spelt slightly differently?
No, spelt the same. There's okay. Also Mozart, by the way.
All right, so some things do transcend all universes.
Indeed.
That is very reassuring to know. Now, we have some questions from the audience that I am going to read out that I got on some small scraps of paper. And the first one comes without a name, but it's a person who is either very astute or possibly stalking you on the internet. And they say, happy birthday for a few days ago.
Thank you very much. Yes, I am extremely old. And it was my birthday last week on the very day that the L'Auberge Sauvage was published, which is pure coincidence, but it gave me an excuse to have a big cake, and the publishers provided me with an even larger cake, so there was a lot of cake going about. But thank you very much for your birthday wishes.
That's the way it should be, lots of cake. The birthday well-wisher has said, you're obviously a William Blake fan. Do you have any favourite works of Blake's?
Yeah, the one I'm reading most attentively at the moment is a poem called Auguries of Innocence, which begins, to see a world and a grain of sand, an infinity, an eternity, and I've lost the lines now. It's that poem. It talks about it's about justice, really. It's got great lines like, a dog starved at his master's gate predicts the ruin of the state. It links small things and great things. It links politics and the world of the imaginary. It's William Blake at his best. Mm.
There's a question here from Christine, which I know you've had before, but I also know that you have an answer to, which is what your demon would be and why.
Well, taking into account...
Philip, I'm going to pause you for a tick because we've lost the line briefly again. I feel bad because I'm confident that it's a very eloquent answer. I have read that your suspicion is that your demon would be a raven or something like it, because it's a scruffy bird that steals things, which is a good description for a writer. I imagine a slightly more graceful bird potentially, but it's your demon, so who am I to question that? I've offended him now. If someone could bring the house lights up just while we try and get it back on. How many people have had a chance to have a look at the new book so far, La Belle Sauvage? Excellent. So you are clearly big fans and you've got out there. For those of you who don't have it yet, we have the excellent crew from In Biggin Books at the back and they are selling copies. You can get them signed by a fellow audience member. It's... I'm going to be honest, there's no discernible value to that, but if that's something you'd like to do... Okay.
Hello?
Philip, it's Michael Williams again. How are you?
Oh, hi. Yeah, we got cut off. But we'll talk on the phone. That's fine by me.
We can talk on the phone. It's if I get a call on the other line, I'll just put you on hold. It's probably my mother or something, but she'd be very keen to join in. The last question was about your own demon, and I was saying that I understood that you thought it would be a particularly scruffy raven. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. But one of those birds, but they do have a propensity for picking up bright, shiny things and taking them back to their nest. And that's what I do. That's what storytellers do.
I've heard you say that you are quite happily and proudly a thief from the things that you read and see around you. When you're in the process of writing something like Book of Dust, where you know there's three books and you've got a lot to do, how much do you immerse yourself in other people's work and how much do you end up having to kind of shut yourself off to protect yourself?
Well, I do read a great deal, of course, all the time, and I don't sort of shut myself away from influences. I think I'm experienced enough now to resist the ones that aren't going to be very helpful. When I was writing my first novel 50 years ago, I made the mistake of reading Ernest Hemingway in the middle of it. And that changed my prose style immediately and unhelpfully. So I don't sort of do that anymore. But I'm more like to fly than like an academic. Can you hear me?
We can. No, you're still there.
Okay. That's fine. Yeah, my phrase is stolen again, this phrase. Read like a butterfly, write like a bee. Stolen, of course, from that great poet, Muhammad Ali, who floated like a butterfly and stung like a bee. Read like a butterfly means I read whatever takes my fancy at whatever moment, and I read as much as I'm interested in, and then I stop, unlike the concentrated, focused, disciplined reading done for academic purposes. And write like a bee, well, that means I take all the things that I've stolen and picked up and found lying around, and I go to my desk and I calmly and quietly and in silence turn them into whatever equivalent of honey I can make. So that's what I do.
You said that you've never found the answers to the questions you ask in organized religion. Are there answers to the questions you ask that give you certainty, or are you constantly in a state of curiosity rather than certainty?
I'm not certain about anything very much except that I know the things I love and I know that I shall die and I know that the world around me is infinitely beautiful and extraordinary and that we're all very lucky to be alive and we really ought to take more notice of the fact. The thing that depresses me more than anything else is stupidity. My own stupidity and the stupidity of people who don't seem to be able to find any interest in the fact that they're alive. That's always very depressing. And that's perhaps why I enjoyed being a teacher, because the children I was teaching did have that curiosity still. So, I mean, something very sad happens to us when we leave our education and go out in the world, and we do a job, we earn money to live on, we have a house to live in and so on, we have a family, but somehow we're not curious anymore. And I wish that would that wouldn't quite be so as it is.
Why do you think that resonates beautifully with me and I suspect with everyone else in this room, and that frustration with stupidity? One of the things in public life that really depresses me is the way in which the expert and knowledge are kind of denigrated and degraded by our politicians.
Isn't that appalling?
Yeah,
isn't
I just don't appalling? Understand it. How did that come about? How did we stop listening to our scientists? Or even, you know, if you're a hardcore market capitalist, we don't even listen to our economists anymore. Or we don't listen to... Expertise is kind of derided as not valuable.
That's right. I mean, in our Brexit referendum, we had Michael Gove, one of the prominent people who wanted to leave the European Union, saying, oh, I think the British people have had enough of experts. This is an educated man. This is a man of some intelligence, and he has the audacity to say that. He's currying favor with the stupid side of our nature. And the line between the clever people and the stupid people doesn't go, you know, along the edge of this suburb or along this natural boundary. It goes right down the middle of our heads, by the way. So we're all prepared to be, we're all capable of being interested in things, and we're all capable of being stupid. And we must not give way to the stupidity. As the poet Schiller said, mit der Dummheit kämpfen Götter selbst vergebens. Against stupidity, the gods themselves struggle in vain.
The great antidote for stupidity is art and is great literature, and it's why there is such comfort in picking up a new book by you in your world and kind of knowing that we're in such safe hands. Do you, on things such as dust with a capital D, how much are you in dialogue with the scientific community, with particle physicists, with people who might critique the glimpses of science that appear in your world?
Well, I do know a number of scientists, and here, living in Oxford, I'm just a phone call away from going and speaking to world experts on particle physics and on all sorts of things. I was invited a couple of years ago to go and see the work they're doing at the Cullen Laboratory south of Oxford, where they're researching into, among other things, dark matter. And they were making the most fantastically, beautifully engineered machinery to make up a dark matter detector, which they were going to put in a mine 1,000 meters below the surface of the Earth. They actually gave me a little bit of this machine, a bit that didn't work anymore, so they were able to give it to me, and it's sitting on my desk now. And when I finished writing at the end of the day, I put my dark matter detector on the top of my manuscript so it can go on detecting dark matter during the night when I'm away from it. But yeah, it is important to keep up with as much as I can, because I'm not a scientist by training, and some of this stuff is pretty difficult. I can't understand the mathematics of it, but the conceptual things, that, you know, the indeterminate nature of particle physics and so on, is a great fountain of metaphor, which is extremely useful in the arts. That's not the only function of science, to produce metaphors for the use in the arts, but it's a very good one.
It's the main one. I think we can all agree that's what. That's okay. Science put to good use. At the other extreme to science and dark matter, I was amused to hear that you gave a sermon on the subject of, was it pale gas?
Yeah, I was invited to preach at the University Church in Oxford. Now, this is a famous building in which, 400 years ago, the Protestant martyrs Latimer, Ridley, and Cranmer were tried and sentenced to death and subsequently burnt. Now, I thought I couldn't resist the invitation to go and preach in this very place, so I decided to preach about virtue. And in order to preach about virtue, I started by telling them about vice. And I recalled a preacher whom I'd heard in our church when I was a boy, who said he compared sin to a pale gas seeping in the A-L-E-G-A-S, pride, anger, lust, envy, gluttony, avarice, and sloth, pointing as he did with each word to a member of the congregation. And this was too good not to use, so I started my sermon about virtue by telling him about pale gas. And then I went on to tell him about my thoughts about virtue. The Christian virtues are very good ones. I'm in favour of all of them except one. I think I'd like to substitute curiosity for the virtue of faith. I think there's more virtue in curiosity than in faith. But as I said earlier in our discussion today, hope is a very good one, and that is one of the virtues, and I'm all for that. So that's where pale gas comes into it.
Curiosity and hope are both good virtues, and both endlessly eminent. Evident in your work. So if the best use for science is to feed arts and culture, I think the same is true of religion. So I think you've repurposed it beautifully there. I have to ask, you talk about not creating your characters, but discovering them and helping bring them to life on the page. In the kind of past 22 years, did Lyra ever leave you, or has she been with you even when you weren't working on the new books?
She's always been there, and of course she's been growing up, because they don't stay still, the characters you write about. They do develop. I returned to her once or twice. I returned to her in a little book called Lyra's Oxford, in which she was about 16. And I've thought about her on and off, but I'm really enjoying the book I'm writing at the moment, with the second book, in which she's 20. She's an undergraduate, she's a student, and she's an adult, really. And her preoccupations and dangers and difficulties are developing too.
And I understand the secret Commonwealth takes us not to the very far north, but possibly to places further to the south. Is there any chance that she makes her way to the most secret Commonwealth of all, the Commonwealth of South Australia?
Not in this story, as far as I can see. The imaginative pole of this story, as the Arctic was the imaginative pole drawing me there like a compass needle in his Dark Materials, the imaginative pole in this one is eastwards, into Central Asia, in fact. That region of mountains and thousands of miles of steppe and grassland, where all sorts of things have come into birth, and where the Silk Road, of course, was the great highway for many, many centuries and millennia, and still is. So that's where the story is going.
Philip Pullman, I, for one, can't wait. I'm glad I don't have to wait another 22 years or thereabouts. It's such a privilege to read your work, and it's been such a privilege to talk to you today. Everyone, please, a big Melbourne round of applause for Philip Pullman.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.
Okay, who should we ring now?